Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of September 19th, 2014. After a crisis, the dust settles. You poke your head out, look around, and survey the landscape. It's a routine we're all familiar with after 2008 and 2009. But it's what comes after that shapes us even more. The attempt to get back to some sort of routine and a sense that normal has changed. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week on the show, we're talking about the new normal in our daily life, our digital life, the very places we live. As always, you can come talk to us about what's changed for you on MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Now let's start the show and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
If you like hype, you will like No, you will love the Alibaba story as the countdown to Friday's IPO of Chinese internet giant Alibaba nears.
Now to late-breaking news from Home Depot tonight. Customers warned of a massive security breach, credit cards hacked.
We're definitely ending one stage of the Fed. We've been certain absolute clarity on QE ending in October.
We're going to talk about the Fed and a whole lot more. Plus, it's the weekend, so let's have brunch. We are out at the Pullman Kitchen on 2nd Avenue, New York, having brunch, and I am joined by Vanessa Wong from Bloomberg Business Week and Nicholas Carlson from Business Insider. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Hello.
Here, cheers.
Cheers.
Yeah, we clink. How are you guys?
Wonderful.
Yeah, very good.
All right. I want to start with the always exciting Federal Reserve. I know, it's a really thrilling topic. But here's the thing. We had Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, come out and basically say, yes, we are going to keep the Fed funds rate low for a considerable period of time. Basically, I'm not going to tell you guys when this is going to end, but it had me thinking we are in this period of abnormal Fed behavior that has now become normal. And I wonder whether there's ever going to be a normal or if all of this is just baked into the way markets and investors and economists and real people now have their financial world exist.
Right. Where are we on wage growth? I mean, maybe that's when things start to change. We start to look at maybe backing off from that, but it doesn't seem like we're there yet.
So. And it seemed like she was warning that, in fact, things may not look so good in the future. I mean, she was sort of saying, look, I want to keep my options open because I don't know that GDP is really going to be there. And I don't know that jobs are bouncing back.
Totally. And even though our unemployment rate is the lowest it's been since like September 2008, it's not that great. And even though they're forecasting the unemployment rate to drop to like 5%, I think, by 2017, not all of those will be full-time jobs. There will be part-time jobs. I think for like the average consumer, there is still like a large degree of insecurity about what their lives will be like and how much they'll be able to invest and whether they can afford a house.
You know, one thing the Fed doesn't take into account when they calculate inflation is food, right? So they subtract food and energy from how they look at inflation. Vanessa, you write about food and cover that. And I'm curious, when you talk to people, how much does food eat into their budgets? Because that's a place where we've actually seen prices rise a lot.
The price of food has gone up for key commodities like dairy. China's buying a lot of dairy right now, so the prices in the U.S. have gone up. Beef has fluctuated depending on what's going on with feed for cows. The cost of food for people is still fairly low, though. It's actually lower than it was in 1993.
Huh.
There was this interesting story about how the average percentage of a household's income going towards food was like greater, you know, 20 years ago. And we were also spending more on things like entertainment and books, which was pretty great. And now we're spending our money on
housing.
And healthcare, which is pretty grim. Like, take me back to the 90s. I want to read a book.
<Let's go. laughs>
Wait, we are going back to the 90s, though. We have a massive IPO. We have the Alibaba IPO, biggest IPO ever, right? It feels like the late 90s, early 2000s. We have this huge company going public that I still don't think I entirely understand what Alibaba does. Nicholas, what do they do?
Sure. So it's a mix of Amazon and Google. So the reason it's Amazon is that people go on to Alibaba. Actually, they go on to a site called Taobao, or another one called Tmall, and they buy things.
In China?
So it's mostly Chinese consumers. They have this big thing called 11/11, which is Singles Day. That's like their Black Friday. It's just like a big Amazon in China. Now, the big difference between Amazon and Taobao or Tmall is that Alibaba, Tmall, Taobao don't own the stores. Actually, those are third-party vendors that come on and use Alibaba's platform to sell to consumers. And actually, Alibaba doesn't even charge those vendors to use the software. The only way they make money, and this is how they're like Google, is that when you go to Taobao or go to Tmall and you search for things to buy, the vendors can buy ads that will appear next to search results. So actually, sort of the reason Alibaba is so exciting is that it is literally the most profitable, valuable part of Google, which is the commercial searches, and that's it.
Oh, okay. So it's all about sort of ads and ranking and being at the top of your feed.
Absolutely.
Vanessa, one of your colleagues did the most ridiculous thing I think I've ever seen in terms of trying to explain how Alibaba works. Can you tell me the story?
One of our colleagues on the video side of Bloomberg, Sam Grobart, decided to experience firsthand how Alibaba works. So he decided to order like 290 pairs of brightly colored pants, like pants in Skittle colors, to see like if I...
To wear the rainbow.
Right.
Sure.
If I were, say, a retailer or just the average guy that needs
200 pairs of pants,
it was springtime.
Like, how would it work? Right. So you go on, you provide a description of what you need. There are manufacturers that come back to you, and you know, you basically select, he describes it as like online dating. You select the one that best matches your needs. So he got his pants for, I think, $9 each, which is pretty cheap.
Yeah.
But then the shipping added another like $7 per pair of pants.
Wow.
But it was pretty awesome. We had like 300 people in our office wearing Skittles colored pants, which was pretty amazing.
I mean, the reason Alibaba is such a monster, and actually just, again, Taobao, that's the big one. We call it Alibaba because that's the corporate parent. The reason it's so big is because in China, they didn't really build malls. They just went from like basically villages to the internet information, you know, age. And so they leapfrogged our mall period. So now, you know, there's this booming middle class. They want to buy stuff. They want to consume. Consumerism is really big in China, obviously. And this is how they get it. And so, you know, it's just taking advantage of this massive market. It's big.
Vanessa Wong from Bloomberg Business Week and Nicholas Carlson from Business Insider. Thanks to you both.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. Today, in our examination of the new normal, a way a lot of people are making money in this economy, going back in time, in a way, to a different way of doing business. Artisanal soap making has grown from just a few producers in 1986 to over 150 today. Same idea with candle makers, quilters, and cross stitchers. Because of digital marketplaces like Etsy and Kickstarter. So is the internet saving handmade goods? Jody Rice is a cross-stitch designer. She has a shop on Etsy. Cross-stitching is Jody's full-time job.
Most of my friends can't believe I do it, and they can't believe I make enough money at it to support myself because they can't believe that I've managed to quit the normal 9-to-5 life. Right now we're in my home office, which is the second bedroom in my apartment. I am a cross-stitch designer, and I have a shop on Etsy called Satsuma Street. It's like a cool version of what your grandmother would have done 30 years ago, 40 years ago. That's what my grandmother did, was cross-stitch and needlework and needlepoint. And now with the internet, there's the possibility for people like me to provide designs for little niche groups of people who want something different than what these big giant companies thought. Oh, well, everybody who does cross-stitch wants to do cross-stitch pictures of a lighthouse on a bluff with a sunset in the background. It's like some of them want to do something much more modern and graphic and interesting. And there's enough of them who want to do that that they can support somebody like me. My grandmother would be amazed that I could make a living doing this. So all my patterns start as pencil sketches. That's part of what I love about cross stitch is that the actual process, it hasn't changed in hundreds of years. And I have this box full of hundreds of colors of embroidery thread. This is my favorite part of the process, is coming up with the colors. It's a Singer sewing machine that looks like an old Singer sewing machine. It's black and it has this like fun, swoopy gold. It's sort of a perfect icon for my business. It's like hearkening back to an era, a design that's beautiful from an old era, but it's a very modern functional object that works in a way that we want things to work now. It's got computerized fancy features and new fangled stuff that my grandmother would never know how to use. There's enough people out there who still love cross stitch and still are interested in this ancient craft that I think is what's so great about the internet revolutionizing craft. Stoli, who's my cross-eyed Siamese cat, and he's kind of like the mascot for Satsuma Street. He's very popular on my Instagram. I learned the hard way that having a job that the rest of the world thinks is glamorous isn't as important as having a job that nobody thinks is glamorous, but that makes you really happy.
That was Jody Rice on how the internet is helping her make money. A survey of 5,500 U.S.-based Etsy sellers showed that 88% are women. Almost all of them are working from home. For one in five, it's a full-time job. Coming up later in the show, we'll explore what we may have lost in the tech revolution.
Solitude and reverie and daydreaming, all these parts of our lives that our digital distractions have sort of shooed out of our daily schedule.
That's ahead on Marketplace Weekend from APM. After the bubble and the crash, the housing market is in a profoundly different place. This week, we asked our community, both listeners and online, about your experiences in the new normal housing market. What's it like to try to buy or sell now? Before we bring in our guest, I want to listen to one person's experience.
I'm Jake. I just closed on a house yesterday. I'm just overwhelmed. I just spent my life savings on this ridiculous down payment. I mean, I didn't have to go into my retirement accounts, which was really good. But, you know, this is Los Angeles, so the house was $1.2 million, and the minimum down payment is 20%, and then you have to have all this money left over. So I had, like, exactly what the down payment was, and then, you know, I wish I'd had it 2 years ago, but I just didn't have it. And my feeling is it's only going to go up from here. We're pretty much back to where we were in 2007. You know, I'm 36 years old, and the last time that it was really a good time to buy a house was I was like 22 years old. You know, I didn't have that kind of money. I also didn't know that they were just giving it away. I didn't know that I didn't have to make a down payment.
I want to bring in a real estate expert. She's Susan Wachter. She's a professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you.
Susan Wachter, I want to get your take on Jake's story because it sounds so reflective of this new normal that we're currently in, a 20% down payment, a house that is quite expensive in a pretty hot housing market, Los Angeles, and a sense that we have ramped back up to a fairly hot and tight housing market. Does that feel to you like an accurate picture of at least where
some housing markets in the U.S. are today?
Well, it certainly is an accurate representation of hot markets like Los Angeles. And the fact that prices have come back to the 2007 highs in markets like Los Angeles is daunting. Very difficult to get that down payment. So Jake's comments, of course, $1.2 million is a home that's way above the median house price. It's not representative of America as a whole. But even the representative home prices in the 200,000 range, 20% down, is daunting, impossible really for young folks just starting out, $40,000. You can get a 10% down payment, but just look at that. That's $20,000. Still a challenge.
I want to play some sound from a gentleman who got owner financing to buy his first house. And he actually ended up doing something different for his second loan because, frankly, we're talking about very different credit markets these days. I want to listen to that.
David Rowley. The second one was a little, quite a bit harder. You had to give him tax returns, Bank of America, lots of hoops to jump through to get that loan. I imagine today it's really difficult, though, unless you get pre-approved. They're going to be much more careful about lending money. I don't think they're going to lend 110% anymore on houses.
Susan Wachter, what do you think about the kind of lending standards we have seen post-crisis? Because there are arguments to be made that, gee, lending standards were really lax before the crisis, and yet at the same time that now credit is so hard to get for a lot of people. Is there a median point that the country should try to hit?
You're not going to get 110% credit. And, of course, those 110% loans without documentation are exactly what got us into the crisis. So, no, we don't want to go back to that. But lenders have tightened up. Standards have tightened up way beyond where they were in the periods of the run-up to the crisis, as well they should. But they've gone beyond that. So if you compare credit standards today to where they were 2001, which is a period way before the crisis when we had actually 2001 earlier decades of lending that was reasonable, responsible, sustainable. We're not there yet again. We're still, standards have eased up slightly over this past year, but they're far tighter than historically were the norm. So why is that? In part, it's because of the experience of lenders that if they make a mistake on the loan, that loan's coming back to them. Reps and warranties are going to prevail. So they're being extremely careful. We need a solution to that problem, and we're not there yet. But the solution that we have right now, which is keeping hundreds of thousands of people in rentership who would be sustainably be able to be homeowners, that solution is where we should be pushing towards.
I want to play some tape from a woman named Courtney who I think reflects that sense of frustration of someone who wants to buy but feels like she's stuck.
We talk about it constantly, like me and my boyfriend, what we can start saving for, and one day we will be able to buy one. He has a good job. If it were in my hands, no. I don't think I'd ever own a house out here. He says in like a year, maybe, we can start looking. I mean, we've got rejected from leasing houses just based on credit. But I have no idea. No idea.
What's the difference, do you think, between, you know, the ownership society and a society where a lot of Americans rent? Does that make a difference both macroeconomically and then to, say, the kind of neighborhoods that we raise our children in?
Absolutely. It makes a difference right now. This is the discouraging part of the recovery. Is not as strong, particularly because housing, which is usually the leading sector, is lagging. The most recent number starts that are out point to still a construction industry that's far below the expected numbers at this point of the cycle, which basically means that we have fewer construction jobs. We also have the fewer jobs across the board in the industries that are related to home buying. There's a strong short-run macro effect that's being experienced. It's part of the reason why the recovery, although it's in place, is not as strong as has been expected. Secondly, the longer-run effects. Yes, absolutely. It's a very big issue as to whether people who want to be homeowners could be homeowners. If they save for a down payment, can't be. And this affects neighborhoods. There's good research out there that points to citizenship involvement in neighborhoods, which comes with homeownership. It affects children's education. Children who have stability in their housing are able to stay in school as opposed to a renter cycle where there's often frequent moves. This is key for children's educational outcome. There are, more generally, in a bigger picture, in those markets that are going to recover and, in fact, expand and flourish, for families that have bought into those markets who are homeowners, well, their rent doesn't go up. Their rent doesn't go up because they're not renting. They're owners. And they can prosper in the community as the community prospers and contribute to the community as the community contributes to their wealth building. This is the story of the building of the American middle class. And it is something we must return to. We must recover going forward.
One last question for you. Warren Buffett gave an interview a while back in which he said, listen, I don't think the economy is really going to recover until housing does. I know you're probably not going to like me trying to get you to put a time frame on this, but when could you see housing really come back?
Well, I think housing is going to come back in the new norm, in the new normal frame, within a year to 2 years. That's not the difficult question. The question of when will housing come back, so it brings us to a traditional role in wealth building, in home ownership for families as they begin their family formation period, that's a much larger issue and one that I don't have an answer to.
Susan Wachter, professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next week, we want you to design your own federal student aid form. What would it ask? What would it look like? Tell us at MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. Our friends at Vermont Public Radio recently ran a story about a new digital currency. It's called, wait for it, Beatcoin. Yeah, like Bitcoin, except with beats. Beatcoin is designed for farmers with small and medium-sized operations. Now, we're going to talk more about Beatcoin in just a bit. It's still a work in progress. But as farmers' markets become more popular around the country, and part of our new normal way of shopping, we got curious about how these farms currently get their funding. We headed over to the Rockefeller Center Farmers Market here in New York City, where we met up with this guy.
My name is Christopher Wayne. I'm the director of Green Market's Technical Assistance Program.
Green Market oversees more than 50 farmers markets in New York. There are white tents with all kinds of produce, apples, carrots, plums, plus pumpkins and some honey and maple butter, and a lot of New Yorkers snapping them up. And while the scene might seem idyllic, Christopher Wayne says there's a lot of financial wrangling that goes on behind the scenes to bring these markets here.
Sure. One of the main jobs that we have is really to help producers navigate kind of a wide range of capital options that they have as small, diversified family farmers within our region. So we're helping producers on a one-on-one level kind of match the best capital option to their specific business. And those options are varied, and each farmer and each position that farmer exists in has a specific capital option that works best for them. So we're out there on the ground working with producers, helping them go, I'm going to work with a federal institution with low interest rates, or I'm going to work with a up-and-coming investor. So we're helping people kind of navigate these potential options.
I'm looking at some of these signs. You've got tomatoes here and plums. Who invests in a farm like this?
For as long as the farm industry has been around, large-scale, federal, agencies like Farm Service Agency and Farm Credit have been investing with these farmers. They're offering highly competitive interest rates. They're on the ground with farmers just like we are. They're understanding cash flow concerns. They're making loans that have flexible parameters that allow farmers to pay back when it makes sense for them to pay back. Farmers can go 4, 5, 6 months without any income on their farm and then have very specific acute times when income's coming in.
We're coming off several years where it's been hard for people to get loans, to get credit. What's it like for a producer to say, try and get a loan for their business?
I think green market producers are really lucky to have the New York City marketplace here. 70 to 80% of our producers say that without green market, they wouldn't be existing businesses. So the 11 or so million people shopping in New York City through our 55 markets are really keeping these people alive in a lot of cases. So we don't deal with some of the more acute issues that some of the larger, you know, further out producers without large marketplaces nearby do. And I think that things like slow money, things like some of the new crowdfunding platforms that we see, some of the Kiva Zips and the Kickstarters, are really kind of filling this gap for certain producers. A lot of the times we see a producer, especially in a land situation, go out and use a large institutional loan to actually purchase that land. But within that purchase are a lot of other costs that come as a role of this. You're increasing your cattle size, you're increasing your orchard, or you're hiring more labor in certain cases. And a lot of the slow money investment and kind of crowdsourcing platforms are covering a lot of these additional costs as we go forward. So there's room for all sorts of investors within this community. And the more interest people are paying, the better we feel about it. The more options that producers have going forward, the easier our job is to do, for sure.
You just heard Christopher Wayne of Green Market mention slow money. That's a movement of investors who want to fund food producers, farmers, and vendors. It's based in Colorado.
So slow money is looking to establish networks where the investors in small farms and small food businesses are local. They're right in the community. They're neighbors, they're shoppers at co-ops, and they are the ones connected with the producers.
That's Vermont Public Radio's Angela Evansy. She's been reporting on slow money and the rollout of Bitcoin, that currency I mentioned at the top of the story.
Since mid-2010, slow money has facilitated about $38 million in investments in over 350 small food enterprises.
And I'm going to try not to giggle when I say this, but there is, I guess we can say, a digital currency with the name, not making this up, Bitcoin.
That is true, yes, Bitcoin. They
like Bitcoin, but, you know, beats.
That's right. And the coins, there's an illustration of the beat coin on the website of Slow Money. It has a picture of a beat on it. On one side, it says, "In soil we trust." and on the other side, it has a quote from Tom Robbins. "The beat is the most intense of vegetables." The founder, Woody Tash, spoke with us recently, and he said that the idea behind Bitcoin is to allow people to make investments as small as $25. So it's about accessibility. It's about making investing accessible to people who don't have really deep pockets, but who still want to support local food, small food producers in their regions.
Lay out for me how Bitcoin would work if I'm, say, somebody in New York, where I am, and I wanted to make an investment in a small farm where you are in Vermont.
You know, unfortunately, since Slow Money hasn't said too much about Bitcoin, I can't speak about it with that much detail.
Okay.
Actually, if you go to their website, the Bitcoin page, it has filler text on it right now. So it's not really, I don't think, fully launched yet. Like I said, they're still teasing it. But I'm definitely interested to see how that does play out. For now, the way that Slow Money networks, and, you know, they're all over already. There are 4 chapters in California, they're in Massachusetts, North Carolina, Ohio, Maine, starting to spread out internationally as well. Switzerland and France are sort of getting their networks started. And of course, where I am here in Vermont, the Slow Money launch was earlier this week.
If you're someone who shops for your food in a supermarket or maybe even in a farmer's market, you may have seen prices for all sorts of different food products creep up. You know, the drought has actually put a lot of pressure on food prices. I wonder, when you talk to farmers and you look at commodity prices, whether getting different kinds of agricultural funding has helped them essentially, you know, weather some of this a little differently?
That's a good question. And I think there are a lot of conversations happening around viability and sort of climate change mitigation as it applies to making sure that, you know, farmland can weather these extreme events. And I think that having a sort of robust, perhaps more nimble community of supporters could definitely nurture a little bit more resilience as we all face these challenges.
Angela Evansy from Vermont Public Radio, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
And that brings us to the weekend number. $505,000. That's how much has been invested in North Carolina's slow money farm funding system. As you heard Angela Evansy say, North Carolina is one of the states where slow money is popping up. 90 lenders have signed on to the system, providing 125 loans to about 98 farmers. In total, Slow Money NC, as it's called, has raised some $1.2 million for small farms in North Carolina. In the investment world, that's a small amount of money, but organizers in North Carolina say this microloan system is critical for their industry to compete. There's more Marketplace Weekend coming up just ahead. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Have you heard of nomophobia?
No, I haven't. What's that?
It stands for no mobile phone phobia. You know how you get stressed out when you don't have your phone?
And I wasn't listening. Do you have a phone charger I could borrow?
This is tech in real life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So we're going to talk about my TV habit in this segment, huh?
Yes.
So that's what we're doing?
Yes.
I watched the premiere of the Mindy Project.
Okay.
Really into that.
I'm gonna make an assumption. Well, actually, it's not an assumption because you told me today.
Yeah, you know.
You have cable.
I have cable. I pay for cable. I am one of those people who pays for cable.
Do we want to talk about how much?
Too much.
Yeah, too much is probably good enough. So I don't have cable. I'm a cord cutter. I'm one of these people who has said, you know what? I can do it. I can do without.
Why did you go ahead and do that? Because I still pay for cable. I kind of feel like a chump. So
I know. And it's understandable. But you shouldn't feel too bad because you're actually part of a very small part of the population that has cable currently but is also feeling a little bit.
But feels really bad about it.
It feels really bad about it.
Okay.
So according to some estimates, actually a study out earlier this month says only about 3% of U.S. pay TV customers are likely to kill their service in the coming year, probably because, you know, they feel like a chump maybe. But you look a little closer at the demographics, like 25 to 34-year-old range, and that number is actually closer to 5%. So the numbers are actually impressive and growing slowly but surely.
So let's say that I do decide to do this, but going forward, you know, there's stuff I want to watch. Season 2 of True Detective is lurking out there.
Yes, yes.
Mad Men is going to come back for the final season.
Yes. Well, it's interesting you say True Detective, of course, an HBO show, Lizzie, because an executive from Time Warner just made a comment that actually suggested the company's open to something that many of us have been wanting for a long time, which is truly a la carte programming that we can pay for without having some sort of cable bundle deal. But if you really want to sort of get all your television content, you kind of have to be a Jack or a Jill of all streams.
Nice wordplay. What in the world does that mean?
Okay, so you kind of have to know what you're looking for. So if you want current and recent cable TV, you should probably go to Hulu.com because that's where a lot of the network TV is. If you want older television, you can go to Netflix. And of course, you have to pay for a Netflix subscription. If you want to find stuff that you can't get on Hulu or Netflix, then you need to start looking at places where you can pay a la carte, maybe your iTunes account, maybe your Google Play account or Amazon Instant Video, which I actually found the movie Scrooged on last Christmas that I couldn't find anywhere else.
None of this gets at what I really need right now.
Uh-oh.
As, for example, the Baltimore Orioles have Aha. clinched their division. Go O's.
Sports. Yes.
Live sports.
Yes. It's a whole different ballgame, as they say.
Wah, wah.
There was this thing called Aereo, which
right.
I believe.
They lost at the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
And are
so
dead now.
Kaput.
And it's actually really hard for sports fans to officially cut the cord. Part of that is about the fact that ESPN makes tons of money from affiliate fees, basically where Comcast would pay ESPN to put it in their cable package. If you really, really want to do it, though, if you want to cut that cable bill and watch live sports, you can buy one of those digital antennas for your television. Costs, you know, around $80, $100. You can hook it up and watch, for instance, some of the games aired by Fox or other basic stations. There's also a DirecTV package that you can buy if you can't put up a satellite dish. But that's like $200 a month and, you know, not worth it.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life and in my living room. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app from the iTunes Store or on Google Play. Think about silence. It's not something you hear on the radio much, is it? But what about in your daily life? Our new digital normal doesn't make a lot of space for just doing nothing. Michael Harris argues we need to. He's a journalist and the author of The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in an Age of Constant Connection. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thanks for having me.
I want to talk to you about this concept of absence.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean now in 2014?
I called it the end of absence because it was going to be a catch-all term for solitude and reverie and daydreaming, all these parts of our lives that our digital distractions have sort of shooed out of our daily schedule.
You have a very clear moment when this became a thing for you. Tell me that story.
So I was basically experiencing digital overload. I had two monitors in front of me at all times. I had my cell phone kind of yapping at me from the corner of my desk. I looked down and a friend of mine was annoyed that it had taken me longer than 5 minutes to get back to him. He texted me, "Are you alive or what?" And I remember looking down at my phone in that moment and thinking, I read it literally. I read, "Are you alive?" And thought, no, this isn't really my life. I looked up at these glowing rectangles that I spent most of my life staring at and thought, this isn't it. And so I ended up quitting my job, actually. And as part of getting into this book, I took a full month off from the internet and off from my cell phone. I wanted to kind of take a vacation in 1985.
I feel like I've read a number of pieces of people who say, forget it, I'm quitting the internet for a year.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of that feels unrealistic with the way we engage with the modern world now. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a way to have a balanced
Absolutely.
Approach going forward?
For one thing, we can batch process our email. You don't have to check your email every time you have a moment of silence. You could live with that moment of silence and then only check your email when it's actually productive for you to do so. There's also large management-driven ways that we can engineer absence back into our lives. Like there's a company in Germany that has set up an email system so when you go on vacation, not only can you not check your email, but nobody can email you. Their emails will just bounce back automatically.
Yeah, Daimler. Not just a company, a great big company.
Right. So they've created a new expectation of absence and solitude, right?
I'm 38.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember a time when I wasn't always checking my email or I didn't have a cell phone. What do you think the cutoff is for kind of digital nativity?
In the book, what I say is 1985 is the cutoff. If you were born after 1985, you haven't really lived as an adult without the internet, right? And that means everyone born before 1985 is really part of this last group of people in history that will remember life before the internet.
Isn't there the possibility, though, that maybe you and I are the Luddites and someone will 100 years from now think, oh, man, they were so slow and, you know, clumsy in everything they did.
There's not just the possibility that that's the case. I think it's pretty much a certainty that's the case, right? Socrates complained about this crazy invention of writing and how that was going to keep people from remembering things. which, by the way, it did, right? He was absolutely correct about it. But that didn't mean that writing wasn't a fantastic invention. There were people who complained about the printing press, too. The point is not that any of these technologies is evil or that we need to stop the internet. That's not the point. The point is that we have this fantastic opportunity being that one generation in history that gets to live before and after the advent of the internet. We have this opportunity to put down in paper or to talk to our children about the value of a previous world so that some form of that world might live on, and maybe we won't be the last people to value a little bit of solitude or value a little bit of daydreaming in our lives.
Michael Harris is a journalist and the author of The End of Absence. Thank you for sharing a little solitude with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. In our new normal lives, data is being gathered on me and on you. Pretty much every second, we're on our phones or computers. Information is also being gathered on kids in schools. Education companies say they hope data can personalize learning and make school a little more efficient. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has been reporting on this all week for us for our Marketplace Learning Curve project called The Quantified Student, and she joins me now. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie.
Adrian, for folks who may have not heard all of your stories, summarize your reporting for us.
Sure, happy to. I mean, basically, the idea is that schools and states and districts and companies are collecting data on kids for lots of good reasons. This data goes into making things like your school cafeteria experience more efficient. They can collect data to help make the bus routes and kids getting on and off buses safer. This data is used to help personalize education, so every kid is getting a lesson that's geared to them. But privacy experts worry that we're not necessarily thinking as hard about the safety and security of student data as we ought to be.
This sounds a little bit diffuse. How much are we talking about?
A lot, a whole lot. Newton, who's a big data analytics company in EdTech, says it gathers millions of data points per kid per day.
Wow.
The CEO has said that education is the most data mineable industry there is, which is kind of remarkable. I mean, I know when I go on Amazon and Google, they're constantly gathering information about me. He says, nope, they have more data on kids than any of those companies have on anybody.
When we talk about, say, online shopping, we're talking about adults. But when you're talking about kids, you know, how much do parents know about where all this data ends up?
Well, it's really hard to keep track of some of this. I mean, there are so many parts of a school day where different types of data are being collected and in some cases shared. So when a teacher takes roll or grades, those records that you and I had, or at least I had on paper.
Yes, me too.
Those live digitally now. And in some cases, those can be shared with school districts. And even some states have started collecting this data about kids in sort of a file that will go all the way from kindergarten to college and even into the workforce to track a kid's progress. But in other cases, we're talking about companies, again, like Newton, learning software companies that are gathering this really specific small pieces of data. And then there are third-party educational apps that maybe a teacher brings into a classroom that might record behavior data or other types of data about kids.
Well, yeah, speaking of safety, what are the safeguards? Are there any?
There are. A lot of data is being gathered and there are rules in place. Here's Jim Shelton from the Department of Education.
So the good news is that there's a pretty robust set of laws and regulations governing the use and the collection of educational data.
There are federal laws that protect some of this information. Critics point out that those were actually written sort of in the age of paper records. States have also been writing their own student data privacy laws. There have been about 20 just in the last year. So there are lots of things in place out there right now. It's a little bit of a patchwork with these state laws.
So how do you find out more information if you're a parent, for example?
Ask. Everyone I talk to, all the privacy experts, the security experts say ask a lot of questions. Here's Shelton again.
The first question to ask is, what data are you actually collecting about my child through which sources? And do you have standard privacy agreements with all of those organizations to make sure that data is safe?
So become that parent who goes in and asks the principal what the school is doing to protect your kids' data. Ask teachers about the apps they're bringing in and if somebody has actually looked hard at the privacy policy.
Adrian, there have got to be upsides to all of this, though, too. I mean, why else would schools and companies be doing it?
If a company like Newton is successful in really figuring out, using this data, how a kid learns and how they can learn better, you can imagine a world in which every kid is getting a lesson that is personalized to that child, that really is encouraging that child to become their best learner. There are lots of other ways this data is being used that's really interesting. I mean, one, at an aggregate level, the federal government can look at the data that's being collected by schools and districts. They do not get individual data about kids, to be very clear. But the federal government can look at aggregate data and actually spot trends and problems around the country so they can look for civil rights violations. They can look for districts where one population isn't being served as well as another and go in and investigate and figure out what's going on. There are a lot of positive ways this data is being used.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill. You can check out the rest of her reporting at marketplace.org/learningcurve. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Every week, we look for great stories about people and their money and the moments that changed their lives or made them embrace a new normal. This week, a comedian explains how he learned to stop worrying and embrace his credit card debt.
My name is Andy Kindler, and I'm a stand-up comedian slash actor slash writer slash producer. I made up that last title, but let's go with that anyway. I have had problems with money my entire life. When I graduated from college, I drove cross-country in a Ford Country Squire station wagon. When I got out to the West Coast, I had there were problems with the car. I needed new tires, first of all. That's how they get you in. So I went to the Firestone, and, you know, unlike today, people didn't trust auto mechanics so much. Back in those days, we knew nothing, and they would often show you a piece of your car, and they'd say, "You see that?" And I'd say, "Yeah, you see that little ridge?" And I go, "That's good. No, that's bad." So how was I supposed to know? I had no money. I had nothing. Zip. So I had to go for credit. And back then, I couldn't call up Mr. Visa or Bobby American Express. But Firestone had their own. They were happy to extend me credit. And they said, "Free financing. You won't have to pay anything to get out of here." I all of a sudden developed many problems with my car. I had change tires on it immediately. And then, you know what? Maybe there's something wrong with my transmission, they said. Quickly, I had run up $5,000 on my Firestone card, which made the other credit card companies very excited and said, "You look like the kind of person who we're looking for." And that's how I started to get other credit cards. And that's when the really foolish purchases began. I thought you could put things on this plastic card and everything would be fine and there would be no repercussions. And so my philosophy then, which I thought was brilliant, was you pay the minimum amount on these cards. This is how they don't get you. You know, a lot of people pay them off early. I say pay the minimum. In those days, you could pay $12 on $15,000. Now they tightened up on that. The consequences were that I'd run up my cards to $30,000. $30,000 in debt. But I have gone through a seesaw effect on my credit up to $80,000 it was up to once. Now it's down in that $28,000 range. What I suggest to people, if you're in debt, is to have a brother who's an investment banker. And that is what I ended up doing. I got more comfortable with the not knowing what's going to happen type thing. I mean, sure, we'd all like to have a Roth IRA or even a non-Jewish form of IRA. I still feel like you have to deficit finance your career. You know, what company doesn't invest at tremendously high interest rates?
Andy Kindler is a comedian based in Los Angeles. He's at the Just for Laughs Festival in Toronto this coming week. You can find him at andykindler.com. And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week.
Remember, our show is always a conversation. You can come talk to us on marketplaceweekend.org or tweet us. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. Our show is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Jenny Ament, and John Sepulvedo. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.